Greetings, listeners. Welcome back to Peace Bound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast brought to you by the Fire and Water Podcast Network. On this show, we discuss stellar runs of Wonder Woman, beginning with the best run of all time, the George Perez written and drawn issues of Wonder Woman from his monumental reinvention of the character in 1987. Now, on each episode, we have a special guest from the larger podcasting community to help me dive into the issue. Today's guest loves all things JSA, but keeps it Opal City confidential. Please welcome Ross Aitken. Ross, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, man. I'm glad to be here. It was, and glad I had the excuse to read George Perez Wonder Woman again. I hadn't done it since it probably came out.
Yeah, I'm so glad. When I reached out to folks to be a guest, I was so glad when you responded. You and I have recorded together with Billy, you know, on Magazines and Monsters and on, I think, A World on Fire and other shows that Billy has as well. So I've always really enjoyed getting to talk to you. And I was really excited that you were interested. And then, you know, turns out you're a massive Perez fan as well, which, you know, is always a sign of good taste.
Yeah, I was lucky to be at that perfect age.
Yeah.
Oh, I got Grell, Cochran, Perez, and Byrne early on.
I mean, that careers. Is, you know, Mount Rushmore, right?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, yeah. I mean,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing, you know, and this is a record for me interrupting my own show, the flow of my own show, but it's okay. If you're men of a certain age, men of our age, I think it is really definitely Byrne, Perez, and I would agree, Cochran and
he has to be because of the Grell. X-Men, let alone being, I think he's the best costume designer, second only to Kirby.
Yeah, and I would add a fifth head to Mount Rushmore with Jim Aparo.
Yeah. Oh God, the unsung heroes of the Bronze Age.
Oh, he's my favorite Batman artist of all time. And so
if on a regular book, some of my favorite early Batman that I read was Engelhart Rogers.
Oh, sure.
And Rogers he knew anything. I don't give a shit what it is. Excuse my French.
Yeah. Marshall Rogers. I mean, there's so many amazing Batman artists, but when I, like the platonic ideal, if you ask me to picture my ideal Batman, it's always Jim Aparo. So that would be, it's interesting. So my five for us of our age would be that. Let's say we were born 15 years later. Let's say we started collecting in the 90s. I'm trying to think of what the five would be. So Jim Lee, Todd McFarlane.
Yeah, Lee, I'm not a big, I love his art. He's not a very good, I have issues with his storytelling.
You know what? I don't disagree. I think Jim Lee's a phenomenal artist, but he's not Perez when it comes
big
to
panels,
storytelling.
Single panels and double page spread. And
yeah.
But I like it. I mean, I understand why everybody loves him. And I've never read Hush. I feel like a bad person that I've never read Hush.
You know, so I'll be really honest with you. I've read Hush and it was like a Michael Bay movie. It was fun, but I don't remember a lot of it. And I don't have a real desire to go back all the time, even though I think it's probably a good comic to have in trade to give people as like a starter Batman.
Yeah, I think if you a more modern audience, because, you know, my taste sends toward, I was a Bronze Age Bay kid.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And a DC Silver Age, because I didn't read before I started doing the Fantastic Four for four episodes with Kirby on my show. I had never read Kirby straight through. It's Jack Kirby's FF. But my post that year, okay, sorry, you didn't finish. You just said Lee and I interrupted.
Yeah, I mean, I think for the 90s, it's kind of obviously the Image guys. You know, it's Lee, McFarlane, Larson. I would put Mark Bagley in the 90s.
Oh, yeah, Yeah.
And you know, and I'm not allowing the guys. I mean, obviously for me, Perez, those guys would still be there, but I'm just doing a new set for the 90s. So Lee, McFarlane, Larson, Bagley, and then I'm trying to think who my fifth would be for the 90s. Oh, maybe like J. Scott Campbell. You know, I mean, he didn't do a lot of interior work.
He was a blip on my radar. Like, I liked Danger Girl, but that's about it. I do like his storytelling.
Yeah, and I liked Gen 13.
See, I hadn't read that one. I think a lot of those passed me by because I wasn't into the Image guys. And then they did Heroes Reborn.
Yeah.
And it was like, I'm sorry, I can't get this taste out of my mouth. It's just so. And I'm not a big fan of, I think a lot of those creator owned ones, I'm not a big Todd McFarlane or Spawn fan. I think they're well made. So he would be in there.
Yeah. Yeah,
because he's so. I would add Tony Harris.
I thought about that too when I thought about
he's in the 90s, but he hasn't done as much as other people. But you know, and Gene Ha.
Oh, wow. That's a good cut.
That's two more.
Yeah, it's tough because there's so
it
many.
It is tough. It is tough because some of them, I've got people that are 80s cut over, you know, they kind of go over. Oh, without putting Perez back in the mix.
Phil Jimenez?
Phil Jimenez, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No. He's got great pull.
Oh, Paul.
Too.
And I'm probably the only person. Was he in the 90s? Paul Pelletier?
Oh, Pelletier. Yeah, he was 90s. Yeah, he a Green Lantern run.
I love his stuff, man. I love the CrossGen universe.
Oh, I did too. It was so good.
I wish those Omnis had sold better. Young Avengers? No.
Yes. Jim Chung. Yeah. He would be. So if I jumped to 2000s. And I'm doing. We'll just do all the 2000s at once because I'm too old to separate the 2010s and 20s. I would do Jim Chung, Dan Mora, current artist.
He keeps pushing people out of his way as he climbs.
Yeah, he's the best current artist out there. Probably Steve McNiven and John Cassidy.
Yeah,
Planetary's unassailable. And then that's hard because like there's Terry Dodson, you know, Alex Maleev. There's so many good artists.
Geoff Johns.
Gary Frank. Gary Frank's got to be.
Gary Frank in there because I love the way he draws Superman.
Yeah.
It's so Silver Age. He's so slender.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's you know, drawing Christopher Reeves. Gary Frank.
That's basically what he's drawing. Yeah, that's the kind of the body type he's picking.
Gary Frank would definitely be in there. I think Jorge Jimenez, who's a current artist, would be in there. So, okay. So sorry to disrail the show, listeners, but I mean, that was a fun little.
Because you got it too, because
fun little aside.
We'll get to it when we talk about the issue, but in the series, it's about how important this is as a piece of Perez's.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is his different. His definitive works are.
I think it's his untime. Yeah, as I read it, I was like, why is this not? I would put this in his top three jobs.
Oh, me too. I would put it top two. I think it's impossible to separate what he brought to Titans from Marv Wolfman, in part because when he was gone, Titans was so bad. And so it's pretty clear he was the secret sauce with Marv, like that alchemy was needed. But this series is brilliant. So let me get back. It's so funny. It's the earliest I've ever interrupted my own show. That's so funny. So, listeners, before we begin, the Fire and Water Podcast Network brings hours of amazing content to the airwaves each month, and we needed some help running the network and hosting our shows. So we started a Patreon. At certain levels of support, you can sponsor a show, and I'd like to thank Martin Gray, Darren Appel, and Brett Young for choosing to sponsor Peace Bound and Down. If you are interested in joining our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/Fire and Water Podcast Network. So Russ, as I do with every guest on the show, I have an opening question, and it's, how did you first discover Wonder Woman?
I had my brother Huey was the old, he's 10 years older than I am. He was the comic guy, and he wanted me to leave him alone. He gave me comics. So I would read, you know, a lot. I started reading in the early 70s, Bronze Age. My first Legion story was The Return of Timberwolf in 197.
Oh, wow. When he's almost assassinates the president?
Yeah, that was the first one of those I read. So my brother gave me certain things. Wonder Woman was never one that it wasn't very good. You know, I was 15, a 15-year-old kid in the early 80s, like 1980 and up to when it ended. I didn't read it much cuz it never engaged me, and doing homework with this, I went back to the first Silver Swan appearance of the original Silver Swan, Roy Thomas Jean Colan comic. Mm-hmm. And then I went, oh, that's what this is. Because his first issue of Wonder Woman is the one after the preview where she gets the double W instead of the Eagle. And I went, I read these and I didn't make it more than like four issues before I stopped, because I was working at a comic shop. So I was like, this isn't interesting me. It's not interesting me. And I don't know what it is. And as I got older, I found a lot of friends that were Wonder Woman fans that were a little younger than me, especially I used to work for a gay theater company. And a lot of the gay male actors, Wonder Woman's my favorite. They have that mm-hmm. diva thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, she's an icon.
And it falls into that. And they kind of gelled her. And it didn't for me. But when Perez George Perez was going to write and draw a comic. I was like, oh, okay. And I remember reading this, and it really came back to me when I started, because last week I was like, I can't just cover 15. I got to read up to it because I don't remember a lot of it.
I appreciate that.
I was like halfway through the first issue, and I'm like going, oh, this is one of his best. This is so much better than some of his work that I forgot it, you know, and this is top tier work. This is some of the best stuff he ever did. And and I forgot how good he did it. And it really did pulls Wonder Woman out of that mire.
Yeah.
That DC had with some of their characters. Like Batman, they found a way to do him the Bronze Age. Superman, they found a way to do it. They would find the right formula, but they never caught it with Wonder Woman or Flash, I think.
Oh,
I think
agree.
Flash suffered. Yeah. I think Flash suffers the last 4 or 5 years because I don't think Carmine, me and Kirby bust on it, but Carmine's not that engaged, and it looks like it.
Yeah.
But I think Wonder Woman suffered that same thing, is we've kept it, they've kept, but I asked my brother, why does this get printed? I worked in a comic shop and they would order like 5 or 6 of them. And he said, it's because they're keeping the license in, you know, they got to keep the copyright up. And I went, well, that makes sense. But it was just this book. Literally this one that got me to read it. And I read it for about the first 100 issues, and then money got in the way, or wasn't in the way, and I couldn't, you know, I had to keep thin my list down of what I bought.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's amazing, though. It's funny, the license piece, you know, they had to keep Wonder Woman in regular print, otherwise the license reverted back to the William Moulton Marston estate.
See, I knew he had a special. He was one of those ones like Kane had. Mm-hmm. He had a sweetheart deal.
Or Alan Moore with Watchmen. You know, if it's not in constant print.
I mean, I get that. Revert. I think James Robinson with Starman, because I think they have that in writing, I think.
I don't know about you. It's funny. I don't know. I mean, you would know better than I do.
Are they just being kind?
Yeah. I mean, you host Opal City Confidential, which is an awesome show on the best series of the 90s, Starman.
And it is.
I mean, it is. It's the best series. It's unassailably the best series of the 90s.
Yeah, because it's not written like it's from the 90s.
No. And I mean, and honestly, I think it's a top 5 series of all time. But it is, you know, definitely I think DC has been, it's more a kindness thing. It's kind of like Sandman, you know, with Gaiman, and unfortunately all the stuff that's happened with Gaiman. But, you know, I think it's that same idea of like, this is such a pristine and complete work.
We're don't want to tarnish it and screw it up, because they've done that. And I'm not saying it because I don't mean they did it because they're incompetent. Just sometimes you fail. You can't.
Well, I mean, yeah, before Watchmen, you know, that whole little thing was, I mean, just, yeah, not a success. So, there's some things you don't touch. Some things you leave alone. And it's funny that you bring up the first Silver Swan. We'll talk a little bit about her as we go through the issue, you know, because she's a different character, a different person. But, yeah, she first appears with, and I, when you and I were talking about this off mic, I said, oh, with Wonder Man. And you're like, no, it's Captain Wonder, but it is effectively Wonder Man. I mean, it's the costume, everything, the build.
So, yeah, they just add some stars and stripes to it. It's really... It's weird to see. I forgot Gene did Wonder Woman.
Yeah. He has a weird run on this book. I love Gene Colan, and I love Gene Colan in particular when Gene is on the right book, like Tomb of Dracula, you know, Night Force, something dark and moody and atmospheric. He is not the right artist for Wonder Woman. I never felt he was good pairing for this book. I never really loved his work on this book. I also, you know, God bless Roy Thomas. You know, he created Wolverine. You know, Roy has written some of my favorite comics ever. You know, I'm an All-Star Squadron fan and Infinity Inc. and all those things. But, you know, Roy has just like people will talk about Peter Milligan from the 90s, the Vertigo writer. There's good Milligan and there's terrible Milligan and there's nothing in between. So like Shade the Changing Man, great Milligan. His X-Men run, perhaps the worst X-Men run of all time. And so there's like really no in between with Milligan. And with Roy, it's not quite that extreme, but there's like really interesting Roy, and there's super dusty, dry, this is my PhD dissertation, this is so boring Roy. And his Wonder Woman run, with a few exceptions, always felt pretty dry to me. So I wasn't a huge fan.
Yeah, I think he works better with multiple characters. I think he is one of the...
Yes.
Because I consider him more so than... I mean, Gardner Fox, yes, he created the super team, kind of. You know what I mean? He created it. He did the first one. But I think Roy takes Stan Lee's type of writing and plotting and takes it to what is all the successful team books
are
basically the same formula. as Roy. It's also what I've seen Levitz as his formula, A plot, B plot, and how you, in a Bronze Age comic, because it was, they're more serialized than the previous era.
Uh-huh.
It's the beginning of serialized storytelling more so. But when he's on, he's on. As I've been reading stuff and like reviewing All-Star, but when he gets, he will phone it in or.
Yeah.
Or just because that, you know, why are you retelling a single issue of All-Star comic over six issues? You know, at the end when they're in Shanghai in space, it's just.
Yeah, he definitely, you know, and some of that I think is post-crisis hangover because he got screwed more than anybody. He and the Legion,
yeah,
you know, got screwed more than anybody.
Yeah, all got screwed. But I guess we'll come up to it, that some books post-crisis have a renaissance.
Exactly.
And this is definitely one of them. It's one of the three that are in my head.
Yeah, I think about, so Shag says all the time that like 1987 is the best year in comics, especially for DC. And I get what he's saying. You know, I agree with that era being one of the best in comics because that energy coming out of Crisis, you know, you have, before Crisis, you have Alan Moore on Swamp Thing, you know, and you have, you know, some pretty sophisticated stuff happening. But you still have, like you said, Infantino on Flash. And, you know, I think the trial of the Flash just ended yesterday. Like, it goes on forever, right? And you have some books that feel like they could have come out in 1950, 1960, 1970. There's no difference. And then Crisis happens. And it's almost like there's a line in the sand drawn where it's like, no, you've got to get more sophisticated.
This is the level that you should be at.
Right, right. We're up in the ante. Yeah. We're not, and not just Marvelizing books the way Marv Wolfman and George Perez did with Teen Titans. We need to go beyond that. Like, we need to be even better than that. And so you get this variety of incredibly creative, you know, Sandman and Hellblazer and Shade the Changing Man, but you get a really golden era of Batman. You know, you get the Superman. I love Byrne's reinvention of Superman, but I would actually argue what comes right after it, the Ordway Stern.
I'm on the same page. I think he built the building blocks. I think when they started to do more books and he couldn't do them all, which is a good thing because he would have tried.
Yeah.
And I find like when you're reading those, the Superman omnibuses, when it's just him and then maybe then Marvin Ordway on some, but it really, I think it's slow when it's slowly moving to the Triangle era. And I think from Byrne's first one, and I would say through Man of Tomorrow is right after that Triangle, isn't it?
Yeah, and in my favorite story, Superman Exile, you know, where he
leaves. I think it's great. I mean, yeah, I think that's some of the best. I think the three Renaissance titles are Superman, all of it, because you eventually get Stern and Wheezy, Simon
Jurgens, Dan.
Oh my
Jurgens.
God, and all those great artists, and they would. There's amazing. It's that Wonder Woman and Wally as Flash.
Yep. Yeah, you nailed it. Yeah.
Yeah. So those are the ones. And they basically lifted up everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Wally became such, he wasn't the, you know, Wolfman and Perez are still doing him Team Angsty, but he goes out and does. He's so much, you know, I read the Baron stuff again for the first time. And it's just wonderful. And those are the three ones.
Yeah.
And JLI follows behind it.
Yeah. And there's this new energy. There's this. So the standard superhero comics are getting better and better. And then you have this rising tide of proto-Vertigo books coming, you know, like even the Dr. Fate miniseries by Giffen and DeMatteis, and then going into the Dr. Fate series. These are all like these early proto-Vertigo books, and they're just amazing. And so DC is just knocking it out of the park, you know, and it's phenomenal. And you look at Marvel, and you know, there's always a push and pull between the two companies. Marvel had been killing it in the early part of the 80s up until the late 80s. And then the late 80s is where they really start struggling. You know, Jim Shooter leaves and you see a real drop in, you know, Claremont's in kind of his navel-gazing phase in X-Men. I still love it, but it's navel-gazy. Stern leaves Avengers, and that was the end of the best Avengers run. Fantastic Byrne leaves Fantastic Four. That book spins for quite a while without, you know, any direction. So it's fascinating, and I love that you put the Wonder Woman book up amongst those pillars because I agree. I think this saves the character. You know, the reason she's still the icon she is today is because of, in large part, this book. And almost any Wonder Woman story you see told today traces its origins back to Perez's relaunch.
I did a little So I've read Perez's introduction to the omnibus, and that's kind of read it between the pad and the omnibus, depending on where I was reading it. And it's a great story because he went into the then editor, and I'm a blank on his damn name now.
Yeah.
Of Wonder Woman. He came in and goes, hey, and he basically tells a story. He's like, he went in there and said, hey, what's your plans with Wonder Woman? And they said, well, Greg Potter pitched this and so-and-so pitched that, and there's not one I like. And then Perez goes, how about this? And the guy was, you know, he says that he looks kind of shocked that why is George Perez asking me about Wonder Woman? This is not, she is, and I don't think people realize this. Prior to this, she is nowhere nearer the Trinity member of Superman and Batman. The book has been struggling for decades. They have not. They've had good periods and bad periods. Kaniger wrote a lot. I guess they're okay. I've read some early Silver Age Wonder Woman. I find entertaining, but you know, it was not. It was never a big. She wasn't as big a star she is.
No.
And then this came out, and she's up. She is the. She there is. That is how the Trinity is born. The third member joins with issue one of this.
Yeah. Yeah. My favorite pre-crisis Wonder Woman run is William Moulton Marston and H.G. Peter. It's the original Wonder Woman, because I think H.G. Peter's art is so beautiful. It's so Art Deco. And so, yeah, you're right. It's a character they really published just to keep the license for years, and because she's, you know, on the Super Friends and she's in the zeitgeist. But
Linda, you know, probably.
Oh, yeah.
No, because when Linda Carter was doing it, she was fighting. The comic went to World War II. And when the show went to the present, they moved it again.
Yeah,
I think the only ones I ever read religiously were the times the JSA showed up.
Yeah. Yeah, and she's basically just female Superman for decades. And then, you know, and it's funny that story, Dr. Ange talked about, and I talked about this on an early episode, there's a little bit more to that story, because Perez walks into that editor and he says, you know, what are your plans for Wonder Woman? And the editor's like, oh, we have this guy, Greg Potter. He's coming off of this Gemini Son of Saturn mini. And Greg Potter's a good writer, so I don't have any issue there. But he goes, we don't really have the artist nailed down, but we're thinking, and he doesn't say who the artist is, but he describes him in that opening as like a cheesecake kind of salacious artist. And Dr. Ange and I really racked our brains trying to figure out who it was, because we're like, was it Starenko? Was it, or not Starenko, was it Chaykin? You know, was it, who would be a cheesecake artist? Because it's a little too early for, you know, Liefeld, Lee, Silvestri, those guys. It's a couple years too early.
It's got to be Chaykin. It really is. Yeah. There's no, because I would love to reread American Flag, but I'm kind of go, is this going to age well?
Yeah. I actually have had the same, I want to reread. There's a couple books, his Black Hawk Blood and Iron book, that prestige format, which I think kickstarted me into puberty from what I remember.
Yeah. I think I had some lustful thoughts looking at, you know,
yeah, it's
at
pretty some racy.
Of his were early work, because, you know, it's, he's one of the best comic artists in a lot. I mean, he's never bad. The art is never bad. Sometimes it's just, he likes a little more pulpy thing. He writes pulp.
Oh yeah, totally. And like his Shadow pulp. Run is great for that. You
know? It is. It's gorgeous. And I remember American Flag being very good.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up in a very progressive household, and this thing about where America would be going, and in the 80s, greed is good. He really could do the satire of our society in that book is there. I just think some of the sexist stuff won't age well, but it's beautiful.
It really is. I mean, what cracks me up is I can't think of Chaykin without thinking of woman in garters and stockings. Like if he drew Mother Teresa, she'd be in garters and stockings. I mean,
and have a gun wrapped around her calf.
Yep, and a gun. Yep, exactly. Yes, exactly.
Mother Teresa plowing down people.
I love that you started with pre-crisis, but then jumped onto this book for, you know, George's run and beyond. And so today we are jumping into Wonder Woman, Volume 2, Issue 15, which is entitled Swan Song. Not so, it is pretty on the nose. It was released in April of 1988. It's plot and layouts by George Perez. It's scripted by Len Wein, finished art by Bruce Patterson, lettered by John Costanza, colors by Carl Gafford, and is edited by the legendary Karen Berger. But before we jump into the issue proper, Ross, every episode of Peace Bound and Down begins with a segment I like to call the Lasso of Truth, where the guest and I each grab Diana's golden lasso and tell one silly, fun truth about ourselves. So since you're the guest, why don't you go first?
All right. In the early 80s, I worked for Steve Jeppy, managing some of his comic shops, and I worked in three of them. Eventually, I was at the Silver Spring location, and we had two levels, ground level and the basement. And the basement was like the science fiction used knob paperbacks.
Yeah.
Stuff like that, and the Playboy, back Playboy stuff. And an office that was really the room where the subscription boxes were. So me or the assistant manager would go down and do that or take turns, because it was a lot of boxes in this. So you had Silver Spring store would be packed. And I'm down there doing it. And I hear the phone ring. So I now need to say this. It was my mom calling. She had some question that probably not important at all, but she was calling me. And my assistant manager answers the phone. So my mother thinks that's me.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
So the next thing I heard after the phone stopped ringing was my assistant manager on the, we had a intercom so you could, call people up and down. He goes, Snookums, your mom's on line one. So my mother had a nickname for all of her children. So for like 2 weeks, it was, yes, sure thing, Snookums.
Oh, that is awesome. That's horrible. But that is so awesome.
I said, Mom, what? That wasn't me. And she was like, oh, he just called me Snookums. So it's funny. She thought it was hysterical.
That is awesome. That is such a very specific pre-cell phone type of event. This is not my lasso of truth moment, but it's a funny moment. My mom hated this girl I was dating in high school, and just the girl was fine. She was a perfectly nice girl. We had a perfectly fine relationship. She dressed a little, I wouldn't even say provocatively. She was just a really tall, pretty girl. And my mom was an older, Mexican woman, so kind of reserved. And so my mom would mention, like, oh, the way she dresses, mijo. And I'm like, Mom, give it up. Like, you're from Mexico in the 50s. Stop. And so one time, my girlfriend calls, and I'm upstairs, and my mom would put her hand over the speaker of the phone. And she yells up, and she goes, Sean, it's the whore. And I go, oh my God. And I was like, what? And so I grabbed the phone quickly, and my girlfriend goes, what did your mom say? And I said, oh, she said, Sean, it's her. I said, I had told her you were calling, and I had kind of was silly. I was looking forward to your call. So I'd been kind of floating on air all day waiting to hear from you. And she goes, oh, that's so sweet. So like I saved the day. But I told my mom, I was like, I am going to poison your tamales if you ever do that again. Crazy. Moms are
crazy. So I'm glad to know that my mom wasn't the only one who listens to phone calls.
Oh, no. Yeah, that was.
Yeah, I was talking to my someone I was seeing, and I was up visiting, and my mom was, someone I met at school down here, she was up here. I was going to go spend some time with her. And I'm talking to her on the phone, and my mom was on the other end, and she's, you're not doing that.
Yeah.
I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
My brother Hugh came home a few minutes later, and my mom was like, Hugh, Ross did this. He was so rude, blah, blah, blah. And I said, but she did this, Huey. And he just went, Jesus, Ma.
Yeah. It is crazy. The pre-cell phone era, what our moms would do. And listen into our phone calls, and yeah, just terrible.
Yeah, there was no right to privacy.
There was no privacy at all. So I'll grab Diana's magic lasso, and I'm going to tell the story of a time I almost caused a plane to execute an emergency landing that would have landed me in jail because of a physical limitation of mine. So years ago, my wife and I are flying to Sweden for a cruise that's going to take us around Scandinavia and Russia. We're ecstatic. Like this has been our bucket list trip forever. We've saved up for years. We're meeting part of her family. It's going to be this big family trip, like once in a lifetime kind of deal. And so we settle in for this really, really long flight. The flight's in the air for hours at this point, and I'm locked into some movie, and I'm not paying any attention. And suddenly the flight attendant comes by, and he's standing next to me, and he's like messing with the bags above me. And I didn't notice, but apparently somebody was trying to get to their bag and the thing was just packed really tightly. And so he's moving stuff around. And so he says, whose green bag is this? And I'm just sitting there watching the movie and I don't say anything. And he says, whose green bag is this? And all of a sudden, he goes, whose green bag is this? If this is an unattended bag, we're going to have to let, and like everybody's looking back and he's got a panicked tone. And I kind of look up at this point, like, what the hell's going on? And my wife puts her hand on him as like his arm. And she goes, wait, it's his. And she, cause we were across the aisle from each other. She goes, it's his, it's my husband's bag. And she smacks me to get my attention. And I look up and I go, oh, that's mine. And the flight attendant goes, why the hell? He was mad. He goes, why the hell didn't you answer when I asked whose green bag is this? I was in a panic. I was going to tell the pilot to land the plane. And I go, because it's not green. It's brown. I go, I don't have a green bag. I have a brown bag. And he looks at me perplexed. And my wife rolls her eyes. And it's a eye roll you could hear back in America. She rolls her eyes and she goes, I am so sorry. My idiot husband is colorblind and apparently has thought this luggage that we've had for over 10 years is brown when it is green. And I go, it's clearly brown. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't understand. I didn't think you were talking to me. You kept asking about a green bag. I don't own a green bag. And he's literally holding the bag in front of me and he's going, this is a green bag. This is a green bag. And he's like practically hitting me with it. And so I just kind of shrug and I go, oh, well, sorry about that. And he puts the bag away and he walks off. And my wife again smacks me and goes, you almost caused an international incident because of your color blindness. And I'm like, hey, you can't pick on me for that. That's a disability. And I'm like, oh, besides, I go, how do you know I'm not color? He's not colorblind. I go, that bag is brown. And like five people around us turn to me suddenly and go, the bag is green, dude. And like they were like totally done with me. They're like, the bag is green. Just trust that the bag is green. So yeah. So anyway, it was the day I learned the true cost of being colorblind and almost ending a one of my dream trips. So, but to this day, yeah, colorblind cannot tell the difference between like olive. If you show me something olive or khaki, I have no idea what I'm looking at. I you could tell me it was gray, green, brown, whatever. I don't know. So,
oh, good God.
Yeah. So not like, you know, my wife never lets me live that down. So let's jump to the issue. In this issue, the challenge of, and this is a pretty important issue. It's a real line of demarcation for the series where we go from steeped in Greek mythology and really almost every story being about Greek mythology to now more of a kind of superhero four color book, though with that mythological background. And so Challenge of the Gods is over. And Diana's back in man's world with Julia and Vanessa Capitellis, and she's preparing for a large charity event put together by Mindy Mayer, her publicist. The night before, she has a spicy dream about Superman, who is having his own dreams about her in his own book. Unbeknownst to Diana, a criminal named Henry Cobb Armbruster, don't worry, you will almost never hear from him again, has other plans. He's been manipulating a young woman with mutant sonic powers to groom her to hate Diana. He's going to have her, in the guise as Silver Swan, attack Diana at the charity event. Unbeknownst to Diana, the Swan has an old friend who was heading to the event to help her break away from Armbruster. The Swan attacks, Diana is shaken, and the Ferris wheel is about to run amok over the crowd, which includes Steve Trevor, Etta Candy, and Vanessa Capitellis. So, fun issue, fun first kind of foray into superheroics. But before we jump into the story, Ross, let's talk about the cover. Why don't you describe it for the listeners and tell us what you think?
It's the Silver Swan screaming, and instead of and with the other baddies behind her and Wonder Woman holding her ears, but she's drawn as a regular character, and everything else is what is this called? A negative
surprint,
where it's they're just made up of blue and white. I love it. I think that's kind of why I asked for this one, because I remembered this. I like the Silver Swan. I think the character they've recreated. They've basically, they wanted to keep. I think they want her to be kind of Silver Agey,
yeah,
in the way she is. That's the point. That's one of the points of the character. But I thought that, this is where the big battle was. I forgot it was just she's only on the last two pages, but it's just a great drawing of her, and it's showing that fine etching kind of. Perez will do it every once in a while. Where it looks like he's done an etching. It's very, very detailed. He does it for like covers and stuff. And I think with that stuff, I think it's great. And it's just blue and white. Everything that's it. She's got skin tone, but everything else is blue or white, including the logo.
Yeah, the coloring is beautiful. And this is, we've talked about this a lot over the course of the series, where really the coloring on the covers, you know, sometimes it was Tatiana Wood, sometimes it was Carl Gafford, is really stealing the show. And this is one of those cases, because it is, it's that contrast of blue and white, which again, the colors of Greece. And so it makes sense that a lot of these covers over the first 14 months have had blue and white. And I do really love it. I love it conceptually. Like, I think it's a really cool idea as a piece of art to have the one physical present character be the swan, who's really angelic, right? The white is this pure white.
Yeah, that's kind of, yeah, I like that. That's kind of why I like her as a villain, because yeah. I like a villain who thinks they're this soft creature.
Right, and who thinks they're the good guy. And she, yeah. You know, she's got this very angelic white, you know, to her that they're using on the cover and they use in the issue. But she's also scantily clad in a very provocative, you know, late 80s bikini kind of costume. So there's a little modern edge to it. And again, conceptually, I love the surprint of Armbruster and the other main characters from the issue. And then Wonder Woman progressively getting in more and more pain at the bottom from the scream of the Silver Swan. But for some reason, I don't know what it is, if it's the level of detail on Diana's face is almost too much. It's like, it's excruciating. She's clearly in a ton of pain. And it's brilliant and beautiful, but it's almost off-putting because it's so hyper-realistic.
Yeah, that, you know, now that I'm looking at it, if you're going to have that and go, if you're going to go there, you know, you want that effect, get someone to pick up the magazine, she'd be bigger and more centered. It is kind of odd at the bottom. But it is, I feel like in this series, the covers are, they're some of the best covers.
Oh my God.
This book always, for the first big, for a long time, I mean, if it's not Perez, it was Boland, always had someone who gave a unique thing. Yeah.
Yeah, this series, it's funny, this volume two is perhaps, you know, I think best known for Perez's reinvention. But the second thing it's best known for is it's the like murderer's row of cover artists, right? Perez does the first almost 4 years. And even in the issues where he's not drawing him anymore, where Chris Marinan takes over as penciler, the Perez covers are phenomenal. There's a cover in the, I think it's in the 30s with the cheetah. That's this like jungle cover, but the colors all sort of jungle printy, and it's phenomenal. Then Brian Bolland takes over, as you said, during the William Messner Loeb's run.
Those are so good.
Well, they're funny. Like, there's one of her working at like a taco restaurant. There's, you know, they're sort of tongue in cheek in moments, but they're also very serious in moments. And then Adam Hughes takes over, a sort of younger,
about that,
coming off of Mays Agency. Adam Hughes takes over, and those comics are not memorable as stories. They're definitely no one's favorite run, and yet each of those books is like a $15 book in the back issue bin solely because of the Hughes cover. And then Hughes goes, and then Nicholas Scott comes on as artist, and then you get, you know, or you get Byrne. Sorry, you get Byrne first, and then you get, Phil Jimenez at one point. You get Nicholas Scott. So, I mean, this series, just a murderer's row of amazing cover artists. And so I do like this cover, but again, the agony of Diana bugs me. But as much as the agony of Diana bugs me, the opening four pages really, really pull me in. So, Listeners, if you haven't read this issue, I really recommend you do, but especially the first four pages, which are drawn solely by Perez. So the rest of the issue, Perez does layouts, but, you know, they're Perezian layout, so they're brilliant. And Patterson does a brilliant job finishing. But first four pages are all Diana. And it opens on this idyllic scene. You know, she's by the water and there's birds flying and it's very natural, very soft pastel coloring. Then there is this lightning and the clouds separate and she flies up and the sun starts coming through the clouds. And then there is Superman standing like a god. I mean, there's no other way to interpret this. He's in the same position Zeus was in an earlier issue when he elevated down from Olympus. They lock eyes. They don't say a word. They lock eyes. They grab hands. They go into a kiss, but then the sun blots out the kiss. Diana wakes up and she prays for guidance because these feelings are very new to her. I mean, you know, she's not really had a crush on a man before. She grew up on an island of all women. And she's also very young. And so she's, you know, confused about what to do. So, Ross, what were your thoughts on this opening four pages?
I think it is some of the best work I've seen him ever do.
Yeah.
I mean, just the first page, and I want to talk about, I'm going to get this, I've been, since I was reading it, it's, I was telling myself I had to remember to talk about the colors. Tatiana Wood and the other gentleman, I forget his name.
Oh, Carl Gafford.
Carl Gafford. Oh, God, I should know that name. This is some of the best coloring I've ever seen in a superhero comic. The light tones, the softness of the colors, the pinks and blue, it is absolutely why colorists, who is a great colorist? You know what I mean? You do, being the colorist is an important job in a comic because everyone's, they're all different.
Yeah.
But this is a lot of pastels, and it's not like tacky 80s pastels. It's just, it's them pushing the envelope on the four color at the, because they're at the end of the four color process. That's going to go away. But you know what I mean? How they have to, when I read an old comic, you know, sometimes, oh yeah, that's right. They had to do this. They can't do that color. So they're, because it's, you only have the four colors. And I think this is a master's class in how to color a comic. And I think it's some of it's some of George's best art. It just stands, this whole series, I think it's his best work as an artist.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think if anybody, if people ask me, why is George Perez your favorite artist of all time? I would show them these four pages. I mean, it is beautiful. I mean, I love that you shout out Carl Gafford, because the thing that keeps coming to my mind is this is newsprint. This is, I'm reading the floppy. This is still newsprint. And the colors he's able to achieve are just beautiful. I mean, the sun coming through, and then the pop of Superman's blue in his costume. And then Diana, the softness of her eyes and the pastels. But then the immediacy of this kiss they're going into, which the only way to describe it is highly sexual. Like there is a physical, you can feel the pull of the two of them to each other.
She's so tiny.
Yeah, and she does definitely feel much smaller than him, which I don't think is accidental. And I don't think it's accidental that the sun blots out their actual kiss. I think this is the dream of a really inexperienced person.
Because she sees herself as a kid. Uh-huh. That's not her grown up. That's...
Well, she's, I mean, she's still... Already,
that's her as a young, you know...
A young adult. I mean, I would... Young adult.
Now, like a teenage, like a, you know, 17 or 18-year-old.
Yeah, and definitely...
And they soften her costume and made it look like the Golden Age costume.
Right. It looks more like the Wonder Girl, the original Wonder Girl costume, than it does look like the Wonder Woman.
Yeah, it does.
And I, again, none of this is accidental. It's all brilliant because Superman, you know, and she's intimidated by these feelings she's feeling, these, you know, she's not used to having these emotions. I mean, look, I love that over the years they've established that she's had multiple lovers on Themyscira and that, you know, she's bisexual, and all of that is great. That definitely wasn't in place yet at this point. So, you know, you would assume that she's a virgin, you know, or whatever. But more importantly, there's no denying she's never had a physical interaction with a man in this, you know, at this point. So, you know, regardless of her experience with women, she's definitely going to be like, whoa, okay, this is new or different. And I do think the little clues of it are so interesting. You know, her being in a younger version of her costume, him being positioned above her in a godly manner. So it's almost like he's not human. And so
that's a bad guy pose.
Kind of.
I think a little bit.
I think more than a bad guy pose, it's a pedestal pose. Like she.
Oh, I got you.
Yeah, like she doesn't know him as a person yet, and doesn't see him as an equal. I think that's what's key here, is that she's viewing him the way she would view one of her gods, and yet is having these emotions for him. And that's going to play up when they first meet, you know, this view of hers. And then she's really freaked out by, obviously she is having an erotic dream, and she's really freaked out by it. And she prays for guidance because she's like, gosh, I've heard of, you know, people giving their lives for physical love and attraction of this kind. And I don't want to be swept away by it. I don't want to be taken over by it. So it's a very sweet, kind of naive reaction to a dream like this, and it reminds you that she's somewhat, you know, she's an adult, but she's a young adult.
But there's certain experiences that don't happen on Paradise Island.
And we're gonna just for listeners, in a future episode, I am absolutely gonna cover Action 600 with a very special guest, and we're gonna talk about the Superman version of this dream, which is a little more grounded. In a farm boy from Kansas, you know, and so it's really interesting. And actually, it brings me to my first secret question of the episode. So Ross, in this issue, it fulfills decades of fan fiction, placing Diana and Clark into a romantic physical relationship in any media, so it doesn't have to just be comics. Are there two characters who are not a couple that you have always believed would be interesting as romantic partners? Now, since I asked the question, I'll go first and I'll give you some time to think. So I'm actually going to stay in comics, and I'm actually going to stay closer to this issue than I usually do for secret questions, because I've always really believed, and I think this might be blasphemy, that Bruce Wayne and Lois Lane would be an amazing couple. I think that they're both brilliant. They both really respect
each other. Adrenaline junkies?
They're both adrenaline junkies. They both really respect each other. They're both really independent. And then she can handle herself, so he doesn't have to worry about her, you know, some villain getting to her, that kind of thing. But the thing that has always in my head resonated why they would be a good couple is there is a ruthless pragmatism to both of them that stands in such contrast to Clark/Superman, where Clark sees the best in everybody, you know, and Clark is, you know, the sort of pillar of good and moral character. Bruce and Lois know you have to get your hands dirty sometimes and know that, you know, you've got to sort of get in the gutter sometimes to fight the evils of the world. And they respect that, and they don't judge each other or others for that. So I've always thought they would be an incendiary couple. I don't know that it would last. It might be like, you know, better to burn out than fade away kind of moment. But I've always really thought, and it will never happen, obviously, but I've always thought they would be an amazing couple, you know, her intrepid reporter and him, you know, Dark Knight of Vengeance. So yeah. So that would be my choice. Do you have a choice of a couple?
Yeah, this is a tough one. It's so many weird ones. Songbird and Hawkeye, they were on the same team, but he wasn't the love interest.
Yeah.
I think they would work real well together. I love her as a character.
Yeah, me too.
She's one of those near perfect characters. No one's fucked her up yet. Excuse me. You know, but yet when you have a character that is so well designed that it's hard to mess. I love her as a character. And I'm a big Clint fan.
Well, and that actually fits his MO as sort of really liking to be the knight in shining armor, you know, because when they first meet, she's a maybe reformed villain, maybe not. And she's, you know, really wanting to prove herself and prove that she's good. And so that would kind of fit, you know, a lot of what his romantic relationships have been about. And so,
yeah.
And then
And if you keep them in the mode they are in, like Thunderbolts, it's a very active team. You know, it's always going from one thing to another. That's why I just feel they could, it's like, it's to me, I think it would have the chemistry of Wonder Man and the Beast.
Oh, nice. Okay.
He's not going to be, Hawkeye's a romantic. He's always written like that. He's really bad. He really cannot read signals. And so I think because in the era of Thunderbolt, I think Hawkeye's at his peak as a character.
Yeah, I love
that. That specific era, the Busick, when Busick had his hands on him.
I think that's a great choice. And what's funny is, like every relationship he's in, she would eventually outgrow him and totally leave him behind, and he wouldn't understand why.
Yeah, I know. He'd be dating some, it's like, he is really bad. The only person who's worse at relationships is Quicksilver.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Quicksilver is such a jerk. He's terrible. So that's right. Awesome. A couple honorable mentions that'll get me in trouble with fans. I've always kind of thought there would be a really good relationship between Sue Storm and Ben Grimm. You know, I actually, that would make more sense to me than her and Reed. I've never really understood. I mean, I guess I do. Like, Mark Waid does a good job, but I've never fully understood why she loves Reed the way she does. But I think her and Ben would make an interesting kind of sense. But again, blasphemy.
But that's a good one, because I think if you were Sue was not always so well-rounded a character.
Oh no, yeah.
And it is not until you get to Burn and on where they go, she's the most powerful one.
Oh, it's Burn. Burn lays that gauntlet down. Yeah, that's like my second issue of Fantastic Four. It's like 259 or 260. Doom acknowledges to her, you know, you are, you know, for many years you were depicted as the damsel in distress, but you are in fact the most powerful member of the Fantastic Four.
I think I would actually put her in a relationship with Doom.
Oh gosh, like Secret Wars Volume 3. Yeah. It does make sense.
I could see them having to come to some.
Yeah.
I think because Victor is, they don't treat him like he's an idiot. You know what I mean? He's very smart, knows how to, and he knows how to talk to people.
Yeah.
Because he, everybody else, you know, he's that diplomatic, that air he has, I think, if he's been written well. I think they'd be a good one. Because she's a good leader. I think once someone gave, made her the leader of the team.
Yeah, she's currently the leader of the team. Yeah. Is Ryan North.
Okay, good.
Yeah, and for anybody who's listening who's not reading the current Fantastic Four run or the previous volume, Marvel did a stupid Marvel relaunch recently. Ryan North is the writer. Umberto Ramos is the current penciler, but it's been a bunch of pencilers. It is the best Fantastic Four run since Hickman and Byrne. It's up. It's like Byrne, Simonson, Wade, Hickman, North. North is on the Mount Rushmore of it's my favorite Fantastic Four run in decades. It's brilliant.
Really, I've enjoyed it. I've been reading it. I've never read the Simonson.
It's really short. It's only like maybe 8 issues. It's he comes in and saves the day because Byrne leaves in a huff, as Byrne was wont to do in the 80s and 90s, yeah. Leaves Fantastic Four in a huff because they won't let him do Fantastic Four and do Superman over at DC, which is kind of understandable. Steve Englehart comes in, and I God love Steve Englehart's 70s work, but his late 80s work is basically just, oh, hey, have you met Mantis? Oh, and Quicksilver's a jerk. Like, there's only 2 plot lines. And so that book is horrible for a good 3 years. And then Simonson comes in and does a very short but very memorable stint. I highly recommend it. Again, only like 7 or 8 issues, but yeah. It's good enough that it's, in my mind, is up there with the great runs. So
yeah, I'm missing the – and I'm an Englehart fan. I've never read Englehart's.
Oh, it's I mean, I feel bad because I have great respect for him as a writer, and he's written some of my favorite comics. But it is – he had this weird thing in the late 80s and early 90s where he was really trying hard to make Fetch happen with the, you know, the Celestial Madonna, Mantis. And I hate Mantis. I don't like Mantis until Guardians of the Galaxy, the movie. I hate that version of Mantis. And he keeps shoehorning her into every book he writes. And then every book he writes is a hit piece on Quicksilver, because he's the one who wrote the Vision and Scarlet Witch mini where Crystal cheats on him. And then he wrote the West Coast Avengers and Avengers Annual where Quicksilver betrays the team to Freedom Force and the government. And then he just keeps that story going until finally, I think Louise Simonson washes it all away saying, oh, it was all Maximus the Mad. Actually, Pietro's a good character. So it's a weird thing. He hated Quicksilver. It was weird. But so back to Wonder Woman. Mm-hmm. We have the dream, and then we cut to the celebration that's about to happen the next day where Mindy Mayer, we haven't seen Mindy in a while. She's Wendy's publicist. She's talking to the guys that she's hired to help kind of build this celebration, and they're mapping everything out. And two of the people note that Mindy's been acting strange, that she hasn't been herself. She's been a little less focused, maybe a little less stable. And that's going to be important later on. So I want to just draw a little bit of attention to that. And then we get this, I don't know, like I swear to God, I know this was just me, but when we get to page 7 and we get to this redheaded character at a phone booth in Boston's Chinatown, I heard a saxophone. I heard like dun 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 dun. I mean, it's like You Belong to the City just kicked in, because this is every 80s Miami Vice, like every sort of 80s plot. This felt like it was literally right out of an 80s like hard boiled. The homicide, life on the streets, something. We get this woman. She's at a phone booth. She's waiting for a call from somebody named Val. A car drives up and almost hits her and then follows her. But before it can hit her and run her down, a shot's fired that takes the tire out. The guy gets out. He's about to kill her. Suddenly somebody speaks to him in what I think is maybe Mandarin. That person kills the hitman. But then just when this woman believes she's saved, he shoots her with a trank dart and it ends. And so I just want to – we're just going to do this a little out of order, because what we learn is she wakes up. The guy's name is Solomon. He is a very like Dominic Fortune, Slade Wilson, you know, kind of, you know, gun for hire type of character, paladin kind of character. And he has kidnapped this woman because she is the close friend of this woman, Valerie Beaudry, who has been through a series of scientific processes overseen by Solomon's father, a scientist, transformed into this creature, the Silver Swan. Now, the woman knows Valerie because they've been pen pals since they were a kid. And
yeah, God, that was a way back machine moment.
Oh, my God. And it's a pretty... Like,
when did you write this? 1947?
No kidding. And it's a pretty sapphic relationship. I mean, Len tries to drop in some lines about like, we were just friends, but it's they were clearly in love with each other, which is great, but I wish they would have just owned it. But Valerie's been, you know, been pen pals with this woman. They are the best of friends, but they've never met. They're supposed to meet, but Valerie doesn't show. Then out of the blue, Valerie calls her. She's in the city. They go to meet. Valerie's beautiful, but she's on the arm of this guy, Henry Cobb Arbruster. Every time she meets with Val, Val's got bruises. She's clearly abused. She's being told to hate Diana. And then she's told the truth by Solomon, which is Valerie's actually this hideous mutant with sonic powers. And through this process was transformed into this creature, the Silver Swan. Okay, Ross, does it get Bronze Age-ier than this? Did you feel like you were reading a comic from 1946?
Yeah, I did. The minute they did the pen pals thing, I was like, and I was thinking, this is 1988. And I was like, what? Yeah, no, I don't think people were pen pals anymore.
I mean, look, it's pre, I mean, the only people on the internet at this point are Al Gore, right? And like, you know, maybe one general, you know, U.S. general. But definitely, so there's no email, but, you know, pen pals, like that is, I mean, she might as well have had a pet rock and a mood ring. Like it's crazy Bronze Age. It feels so, and the guy might as well have like, you know, Jade Wilson on his shirt or, you know, Dominic Fortuna or like, I mean, he's such a pastiche character. Now, I'm not disparaging it. I actually, it resonated with me in my love of Bronze Age goodness, but it is so out of place in this comic. I'm glad. Do you felt the same way?
Yeah, I really did because it feel like I'm watching an 80s cop show.
Exactly.
And that scene, like, you know, you're going to hear the noise and or act, God, showing my age, where they'd actually give you the act number on the screen. that was an NBC thing. But yeah, I forgot all of this because this is the second time I've read the series and that they were 30 years apart, more than that. It's very Bronze Age. You know, it's the way he's drawn. It's secret agent type two.
Yeah.
Actually, when I first saw her at the phone booth, I thought it was Vanessa. And I went, why is Vanessa drawn like that? And why is she walking around like that?
Yeah, yeah. Like, when did Vanessa start becoming a prostitute? Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
But yeah, this whole side thing with the origin is so we were pen pals and then but I didn't know she was a hideous monster. It could have been a Legion story.
And not only that, but this feels like, and tell me if you think I'm wrong, this feels like a script Len had written for another book, like Codename Assassin or some other comic that he wrote in the 70s or early 80s or like a, you know, DC special or something. This feels like a rehash plot. This feels like something Len had in his desk. And George is like, hey, we're creating a new Silver Swan. I need an origin story for her. And Len's like, oh man, have I got it for you? And it feels like a rehashed plot from something he saved from something he couldn't maybe use for some reason. But it also feels like a backdoor pilot for this guy, Solomon, this like secret agent, Solomon Buchanan. Even his name is, you know, sort of dead.
Sounds like the name of a bad detective show on NBC in the late 70s.
It absolutely does. I mean, this screams of like the Scarecrow and Mrs. King or, you know, some sort of like, you know, woman who's not a PI and he is, and they you know, form a begrudging partnership, you know, Remington Steele or something. So it leads me to a secret question. Actually, I have a couple from this section, but my first one is, and this, you're the guy to ask, you're Mr. Bronze Age. So immediately when I read this, I thought about you. Is there this again? This plot feels very, very Bronze Age comics, very 70s cop show. Is there a story trope that you miss from the Bronze Age of comics? Is there just something that would be very Bronze Age-y and that you always loved that isn't present today? So, like I said, I'll go first since I asked. And in my mind, the thing I really miss from the Bronze Age that I wish they would do more of today is Dial the Soap Opera up to 11. I love a Peter Parker, you know, is it Mary Jane? Is it Gwen Stacy? You know, is it Betty Brant? Is it Felicia Hardy? I love a Peter Parker, you know, torn between two lovers, feeling like a fool kind of thing. I love a Legion, you know, a lightning last blushes when Timberwolf Wuff walks in, and, you know, we have, you know, Lightning Lad and Saturn Girl flirting all the time, but they can't get married because then they have to leave the Legion. And but then she has a whole moment with Timberwolf on this frozen planet. And what does that mean? And, you know, I really, and it doesn't mean that, like, subplots, and I guess what I really miss is subplots, but it doesn't mean that subplots are gone from modern comics. But modern comics, it's such a cutthroat industry now, and they're expensive. So they have to really get to what sells fast to keep people's attention. And we've kind of lost, I don't know, romance and like, you know, soapy romance from comics. And I just miss it. I really love that. Some of my favorite comics are because of those relationship building moments. So what about you? What's a Bronze Age trope that you miss?
Do you like the romance that they did it better? It was interesting. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like 70s Roy and Englehart, you know, had the right level of that. I do love that one. It's a tough one. It was a tough one for me to do it when I was doing my notes. Oh, the thing, there's a Bronze Age trope is it comes in superhero teams. The oddball lineups.
Oh, yeah.
You know, no, like coming yes. Englehart's Avengers.
Yes, yes,
you
yes.
know, the Defenders. These are all, there's a certain thing of, I think, even though they're probably more modern, but Batman and the Outsiders.
Mm-hmm. No, they're Bronze Age in their first iteration.
Yeah, and they're a very odd team. It's not something, you know, I read the book. I would never put these characters together.
Mm-hmm.
That where they mix and match. I think that's what makes certain super team writers good, is they got to go, you change the, you know, it's the right combination of parts. And they really did it. I think there's a golden age. I really love almost every super team during that early Bronze Age,
mm-hmm.
because they're all test driving this stuff. And yet, I mean, Gerber knew how to do it and add comedy.
Yeah.
Because they will not do something funny in a superhero comic today.
I mean, occasionally, but yeah, you're right. It's very rare. And so, yeah, humor was missing, that sort of the ability to laugh at yourself. I mean, those Defenders comics, you know, Hulk wants beans, you know, yeah, they were great.
Yeah. I think that's some of the best Hulk is that Gerber Defenders one. But, Dad, I like those oddball teams, and there were a lot in them.
I love – this is a brilliant observation on your part, because you're right. We don't see it anymore, and I miss it because there was a very specific reason they did it. If you put Captain America, Thor, Iron Man, and the Avengers – you can't do anything to them, that it has to happen in their own book. But if you put Scarlet Witch, Vision, you know, Quicksilver, Mantis, Swordsman, Hawkeye, that's where your soap opera comes in.
Yeah.
That's where your life and death risks come in. That's where, I mean, it's why the JLA, and you know, some people mistakenly call this a failure. I think it was brilliant. But that's why Jerry Conway breaks up the Big Seven at one point and goes to the Detroit League, because he's like, I can actually tell real stories with these characters.
Yeah.
I can kill them. I can put them in danger. And so you don't see – I mean, like, I think about the current Avengers book, and I love Jed McKay. He's actually my favorite writer at Marvel. So I this isn't anything about Jed McKay or the creators, but the current Marvel Avengers book is Carol Danvers, Captain Marvel, you know, Thor – Sam Wilson, Captain America, Scarlet Witch, who has her own series, is a movie star now. You know, like, it's Storm. You know, it's characters where I'm like, hey, this is fun, but no one's dying, and no one's falling in love. I'm not going to see any subplots here because these characters all have their too high profile IP. Give me a book with Mockingbird. You know, give me a book with characters who can have some actual growth.
I'm glad I'm not the only one, because I like Jed McKay.
Yeah, me too.
It's not just his, the run before his. Jason Aaron. I like some of Jason Aaron, but it was uneven.
Yeah,
I don't like the lineup. The lineup is, I find it, it's like, you do not have to have, it's time to give these characters a rest.
Yeah.
The only two I would keep in it would be Vision and Scarlet Witch, because they've had too long a rest.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
They should be, and fix it, get them back together.
I agree.
Don't break it.
I love John Byrne.
If it's not broken, don't break it.
I love John Byrne, but I will never forgive him for the "She fell in love with a toaster. I have to undo this." I mean,
oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I hate, my friend of mine goes, "Don't you love Byrne?" I do love John Byrne. I don't want to talk about his West Coast Avengers.
No.
I'm upset about the bullshit he pulled.
In my head canon, Byrne doesn't touch West Coast Avengers, and he never posts anything online. And that way I get to preserve my love of John Byrne. So this is definitely a Bronze Age story. Now, the other – this is a smaller question. This feels like a backdoor pilot for Solomon Buchanan, PI, or something. So my second question to you, or my third question to you, would be, do you have a favorite – from any medium, do you have a favorite backdoor pilot? For those of you who don't know, a backdoor pilot was where they would take a normal TV show and they would have a special episode like Happy Days where Laverne and Shirley were on it and they were going to launch a Laverne and Shirley show, or Mork and Mindy, or the Jeffersons being the neighbors of Archie Bunker. I'm using a lot of really old examples.
Mine's going to be a little older too.
Okay, so I'm going to do a comic book example first, and it would be Deathstroke the Terminator. You know, he's a villain. He's the chief villain of the new Teen Titans for years. And then people start kind of loving him as an anti-hero, and Wolfman picks up on it. And there's a couple of issues in the Baxter run of Titans that are just Slade Wilson solo stories, and they launch the Deathstroke the Terminator ongoing. So nice little backdoor pilot, shows what the series is going to be about. I bought in because I like that character. And then from TV, there's so many examples on TV, of characters that came from other characters. But I'm going to go, and this is, I'm going to be the oldest person on the planet here, but there was a show JAG, which was about Air Force officers. And there is an episode where they have Leroy Jethro Gibbs comes on from NCIS to help them investigate. And that launches a show called NCIS with Mark Harmon, which has now been on the air for like 23 years, I think. Mark Harmon's not even on it anymore. It's been on forever.
It's Gary Cole.
Yeah, and I love NCIS as background TV. Like, if there's nothing on, all and there's a marathon on like TNT, I'll watch a bunch of episodes just because they're fun, and old people love it. It's injected into their DNA. But it was a backdoor pilot show. People forget that. So what about you?
Mine, it's gonna, as a nerd, it's gonna be lazy, but Assignment Earth.
Oh.
From Star Trek.
Nice.
There is a kitsch value, and I put on streaming channels like Tubi or whatever. I have been watching How the West Was Won, not How the Wild Wild West.
I would love that show.
I do. It's really weird. And why is he dressed like that? The little short thing and the tight.
Dr. Loveless is the best villain of all time.
Oh, great. But it would have fit, Terry Garr and the other guy, mm-hmm. and the weird science fiction. You could have done a lot. It would, I think it would have been a good one.
No, it's a great, great choice. Any comic book, any like that you can think, like I think of like.
Oh, Thunderbolts when they appear in Hulk.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. New Warriors appear in Thor. So yeah.
They did that. Because there's some good. I had never read New Warriors until I got the Omnis. And it was like, this is really good.
The first 3 years of that book are unassailable, especially the first two.
So good.
With Bagley.
There's some choppy stuff.
Yeah, I loved that book. And shout out to Come Out and Play, a New Warriors podcast by the guys at Longbox Crusade, because that's a great show.
Oh, cool. But yeah, Thunderbolts.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Yeah, because that whole thing is because they could have just blown it off if they didn't do well, but people are intrigued, and then Busick goes, "Yeah, can I have the comic? Can I do it now, boss?"
Well, they used to do that in comics much more. Like Hawkeye, the 4-issue Hawkeye miniseries in the '80s from Mark Gruenwald is maybe my favorite comic ever, and it spins out of Avengers. He breaks his leg on a mission with the Avengers, and he has to step down from the team. And he takes a gig. He needs money. He takes a gig as Cross Security, head of their corporate security. And Cross, it turns out, is Crossfire, a bad guy. And that's the whole point of the Hawkeye mini. So, yeah, so backdoor pilots used to be a real thing. And they still kind of are. I mean, my wife just finished watching a show called Ballard, which was based on a side character from the show Bosch, which ran forever. That's a kind of a cop show. And so they still exist. But yeah, I love the day of the backdoor pilot. So back to the action of the book. We get Valerie Beaudry as the Silver Swan. We get no character development from her other than that she is abused by this Henry Cobb Arbruster guy. We actually don't even really know why in this issue he wants to attack Wonder Woman and the celebration other than just super villainy 101. But Diana goes to the celebration. She's kind of put off by it because it's so over the top, very Mindy Mayer. And she's like, wow, this is almost like worship. I'm really not into this. Maybe I should say something, but, you know, it's for charity. And before anybody can do anything, Silver Swan attacks. She's beautiful. She's angelic, but she's been abused into hating Diana. She attacks again, and Diana's felled by her scream, and this time it hits the Ferris wheel, and it ends on a cliffhanger of the Ferris wheel coming unhinged. And in the crowd are Steve Trevor, who Diana wants to talk to because she met his mom, the ghost of his mom. She wants to tell him that. Vanessa, who's secretly kind of jealous of Diana because her little turd of a boyfriend is really into Diana. And then Etta Candy's heading that direction. She's a little jealous of Diana because Etta's working hard to get fit and Diana's so beautiful. So there's all these kind of little subplots too. But what did you think of the Silver Swan's attack?
I think it looks – she looks great. Page 21 where she's flying between the panels, she looks really good. I wish there had been more action, kind of. I like her.
Yeah.
The scream. Okay, cool. I forgot that this 2 pages. It's like, I mean, that's good. It's good storytelling because we're kind of like, well, what happens? You know, but I really like it. I like the use of empty space in that one panel.
Yeah.
Where there are panels, but anything involving the swan and being in the white, that's the only other color.
Yeah. And we don't get much of her. She has no agency in this issue.
I'm just kind of thinking, I'm trying to remember, because there have been how many different versions of the swan now?
Well, this is the second. So the first version was Helena Alexandros, and she was a ballerina, and she was bitter. This is so like late 70s, early 80s. She was bitter because while she was a wonderful dancer, she felt she wasn't getting parts because she had a very plain face. And so she was really angry. And it just turns out she was a descendant of Leda from the myth Leda and the Swan, where Zeus rapes Leda in the form of a swan, which is horrific if you know anything about swan genitalia. And don't ask me why I know anything about swan genitalia, but it's really a horrific image. And so Ares plays into her bitterness and he lets her turn into this beautiful silver swan creature person, giving her these powers for 1 hour a day. It's a really weird thing. If she kills Wonder Woman, he'll let her be Swan forever. And then, like you said, she teams up with, you know, Simon Billiams, you know, Captain Wonder, a.k.a. Wonder. I mean, Roy's not even trying at this point. And they fight, and she's not – she's only a it's funny. She's not a prevalent Wonder Woman villain. She's relatively recent, and she only appears in a few issues. So to reinvent her was an interesting choice by George and Len, because it's not like she's a classic Wonder Woman villain. But it does lead me to a secret question. So this issue introduces a new version of the Silver Swan, a post-crisis version. What is your favorite post-crisis reinvention of a supervillain? Now, I'm going to go first for two reasons. One, I asked the question and I want to give you time to think. But two, I'm 100% sure I'm going to steal your answer because you're the Starman guy. You're the James Robinson guy. And my answer is, of course, The Shade. I mean, The Shade prior to Crisis was a fun villain. Shadow Powers fought Jay Garrick, fought Barry Allen, you know, fought Infinity Inc. in Canada with the Global Guardians, but was just a little mustache twirling villain who cast shadows. And then James Robinson gets a hold of him and makes him, I would argue, the most compelling character in that book. I mean, Jack Knight's great, but The Shade is... I just think he's one of those guests, or not guests, but like ancillary characters or supporting characters who eclipse the main character at one point. And you know, he gets
his
own.
The Garrick of that book.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, he is Opal City. I mean, he is absolutely the DNA of that book, and his writings in the back of those issues add so much to the story. And he's Jack's mentor, but he's also questionably a villain. He's, you know, very much out for his own motives, but his own motives are to protect the city, so they line up with Jack's. And I love that character. I think that he is perhaps I think he's the greatest post-crisis reinvention of any character. And I think he is what Robinson does with him, with history, with his archenemy in the Grand Guignol arc, which is long but is still brilliant, and you know, is just unassailable. So I go with The Shade, and I'm sorry, I probably stole yours.
No, but, I I thought of him, and I also thought of Solomon Grundy from
that
Solomon Grundy is really many Grundys.
Yeah.
I really like that. But so I don't want to do a Starman one because I talked about Starman a lot. I have mine was like a two-way thing is after Crisis, I love Luthor as a businessman and being older than Superman and Lois. Not a lot of years, but a little bit older. And the Penguin just being a master criminal, a gangster. A gangster. People call him the Penguin. Ostrander used him perfectly in Suicide Squad.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, he's an expert on eggs. Yeah, it's a, you know, the Penguin thing. He's like, it's shtick.
Yeah.
But he's really, you know, and I like him in, I don't read a lot of Batman, but I like the idea that he owns a nightclub and Batman doesn't close him down just because he doesn't, you know, he gives him something to do. I think it fixed some villains.
Yes.
And I think it fixed Luthor a great deal. I really think the first few years post-crisis of Superman, that's one of my favorite Luthers.
There is a moment in issue 2, I believe, of Byrne's relaunch of Superman. So Superman Volume 2, there's a backup story with Lex Luthor. And I know Dr. Ange, I know people are already like, yep, shaking their heads. I don't know if you remember this story, but it's Luthor in the limo with Mercy's the driver. And they pull into this little diner in like podunk, you know, part of the state. And there's this somewhat attractive waitress and Luthor makes an offer to her. And this is before that Robert Redford, Woody Harrelson, Demi Moore movie. Luthor makes an offer to her and he says, oh, you're quite fetching, come live with me for a month and basically I'll give you like $1 million. And she's like, what? And he's like, yeah, he's like, you will do whatever I say, whenever I say for a month, I will give you $1 million at the end. Think about how much that would change your life. And she thinks about it and like her husband works at a garage and she's a waitress and this would transform everything for them, but it would break his heart. And she's tempted and she even calls him to hear his voice at his work at one point. And, you know, she runs to the back to call him and then she runs out, you're assuming to say yes, and Luthor's already driven away in the limo laughing. And it captures what a bastard he is so brilliantly that it is my favorite version. I agree with you. Businessman Lex Luthor's my favorite version.
I just think it made them better. I mean, just you had to flesh them out. I didn't like that everybody knew who all that crap. Superboy beat Smallville is very Silver Age. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Silver Age is like, it doesn't make sense that there would be this much crime in a town.
It's all a small town in Kansas. Yeah,
it's like Midsummer Murders.
Yeah, exactly. I love
television.
That show.
It's like, man, what is this county you live in? It's like a death match.
Right, right. It's that. It's the city that Angela Lansbury lived in for Murder, She Wrote, where it's like, how many people have to die before people move away?
So I really kind of like that they made those changes to some of the bad guys, which is I got a secret question.
All right.
All right, we've talked about Wonder Woman at the beginning, that Wonder Woman was not that big a deal. That she wasn't selling well. It was this, and this brought her all the way up and made her as important as Batman or Superman. What other female character from pre-Crisis DC Universe would you – which one would you like to have had gotten this treatment, this upgrade?
Oh, that's a really good question. Do you want to go first?
Yeah, I'm gonna say it's Jacette Zatanna. Why she didn't? You know, you could have made her a big thing. I don't know. They've just maybe not found the right writer. But I think she could have been the third character. Because I always liked her. I've read more comics with Zatanna in them than I probably did Wonder Woman.
Yeah, that's a great choice. I love Zatanna. She's had a little bit of a renaissance recently. With some really very good miniseries, but you're right. Never sustained her own book. Or well, she did have her own book for like 12 issues in the.
I like her in Avenger, Justice League Dark.
Me too.
I like her. That's a good. Put her in a group. Make her more important. Make her in a super team. Make her the leader. That would be a really good idea.
Yeah, that is great. That's character. A great question. Great choice. So a couple characters who got shine post crisis. That I really am happy they got more attention for, I would say, are Barbara Gordon, you know, the transition from Batgirl to Oracle and Oracle becoming a pillar of the DC universe, was awesome. Black Canary went from Green Arrow's girlfriend, basically, to, you know, now the head of Birds of Prey, and has, you know, been the main character in a team book that's, you know, if you combine all the issues of it, is well over 200 issues, which is pretty awesome. But a character who hasn't gotten the attention that I wish had is Vixen.
That's a good one. I like her.
Love Vixen.
She started to work with us when Ostrander was writing her, and people went, oh, that's who she is.
Well, love her. I loved her in the JLA Detroit. She was my favorite. And I think she was the breakout character of that book, but that book is not fondly remembered. So that's, you know, kind of damning with faint praise. But she has so much potential. Her power set's easy to understand and is amazing. She's visceral, but she's also like a clothing designer and a model. So she's got this really cool professional side. She's, you know, has a different heritage than most heroines. I think she's Nigerian, you know, and just is a really complex character, and is also very modern, like very sexual, you know, and when she wants to be, you know, is not a damsel in distress ever, is a real badass. And is, I just think, you know, she got some shine on Justice League Unlimited on the cartoon in her relationship with Jon Stewart. But again, that's a female character getting her, you know, shine because of her relationship to a man. I would love to see Vixen get her own book and become amongst the pantheon of DC characters that people first think of. So great question. That was a great question.
Yeah, because I talk about it. As I reread stuff, I see some comics that really – or reading a Bronze Age or late Silver Age comic and how they wrote women. It was like, ooh.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the problem with pre-Crisis Wonder Woman that I didn't really like, was these are all like 25-year-old guys. No, I just felt there was no female input into it at all.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. I mean,
like she's just I don't think a lot of times they wrote women really well.
I don't either. And even though, you know, Perez, you know, is obviously a man writing Wonder Woman or plotting and drawing. He has such a beautiful aesthetic, and there is a real strong femininity to his work that I love, and it permeates this book. I mean, it's just phenomenal.
He gets it. He really gets it.
It's beautiful. I mean, it's the DNA of Wonder Woman going forward. So Ross, the issue ends on the Ferris wheel. I mean, it's even that is like a very Bronze Agey. Oh no, the Ferris wheel's come unhinged, and no, so we'll see the next issue. And this is a fun issue in that, again, it is the transition from, hey, Greek mythology is going to dominate everything in this book, to we're going to break away at times and do some four color superhero stuff. And
I call it doing the Thor. Thor does.
Yeah,
my brother. I like Thor, and I've read a lot of it because my brother made me, because he just loves it, and it's good. But it's what makes that character interesting is he's a space hero, he's a superhero, he's mythological. So you really let the writers do a bunch of stuff, and it would make. And sometimes when he was doing superhero stuff, you'd go, it's really silly that you're battling the Wrecking Crew.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like Firestorm fighting Slipknot, you know, or somebody, or Moonbow, or somebody. You're like, wow, really? This guy's the most powerful guy in the universe.
Yeah,
I do love that about Thor, and it's funny. I hadn't thought about this until you brought it up. My love of Thor very much mirrors my love of Wonder Woman in that my favorite Thor runs are steeped in mythology. I mean, obviously the Walt Simonson run is, you know, number one, you know, that run from the 80s, but that's all mythology all the way through from beginning to end. And then the Jason Aaron run that wrapped up about 5 or 6 years ago, which was the, you know, brilliant as well, but also steeped in mythology. And so, all my favorite Thor runs are always mythology based. That's really funny. That's interesting. So
yeah, I mean, that's what I like about this, because when I started the reread with one, is I was like, oh damn, man, I forgot they're doing Greek gods pedal to the metal, man. They have both feet on the gas, no one's steering. Come on, let's do it. It's great. I think it's amazing. I think it is a huge fix.
Yeah,
for this character, because of the you know, the Purple Ray, the Kangas, that stuff got to be kitsch.
Mm-hmm.
But to have them very connected to the gods is so – I just think it works so much. It gives them more things to do.
When it separates her from other DC heroes, you know,
she's the only one in the DC universe.
Yeah, she's the DC hero who will solve will end a fight with a hug and with love and compassion. But she'll also you know, cut a bee. She'll, you know, she'll fight you. She'll kill you. She's like the fiercest warrior, but she's also the most loving and compassionate. And that dichotomy is what makes her different from everybody else, right? I mean,
oh, yeah.
Superman loves everybody. Batman's the fiercest warrior. She's the mix of the two in her own unique way. So,
yeah. So, well, I like that she's a nurturer.
Me too.
She does it. And Perez puts it really front and center.
Oh, yeah. No, it's the DNA of this book. It's the thesis of this book that this is what makes her different and will continue to, you know, even to today. So this brings us to the end of the issue. But before we get to our last segment, let's talk about our favorite panel. So do you have a favorite page or panel for the art in the book?
Hey, I think we're both going to have the same answer.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Page two.
Yeah.
That could have been a cover.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I love how big the cape is. It's not, that's way more cape than Superman has. I think that's more because of the dream state and her in the softer costume and being younger. It's a really good page.
Yeah, it's the splash page of Superman emerging from the sun and standing over her like a god, and she's flown up to meet him. And, you know, we talked about it at length. You know, about all the symbolism in it, you know, her in a younger costume because she feels more inexperienced, him in a very godly pose. There's a pronounced bulge. I mean, there's some sexual, you know, his muscles are all drawn. There's very visceral. And then the cape being so billowing, you know, kind of like a bed sheet, but also protective, right? So like everything in these images is a juxtaposition of these awakening sexual feelings she's having, but also this awareness that she's maybe not ready for them. And so it's just brilliant. I mean, it's Perez at his best. So yeah, same thing. I mean, there's no point even getting cute with it. That's the best panel in the book and maybe one of the best panels Perez has ever drawn.
Yeah, so. It is. I like it when he'll take it. I love it when he does something like it's a regular Teen Titans comic.
Yeah.
You know, all the stuff that's going on, but he'll have a page or panel that is just to give you, shows you where they're at. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? And it'll be static and kind of like that one is, we know exactly what the intent of it is. It's just, he makes this a whole page to get people thinking, like to really test the waters, you know? I mean, I don't know if you read letters, but like, will this fly? Is this a good story? Let's just, you know, he's putting his gauntlet down. Let's just try something. And that's what makes it powerful too. It's like going, because it's, you said, like it's years of fan fiction. You know, this is what some people have always wanted.
Yeah. And it's really funny because it echoes through time. We get post-crisis, everything's possible. Universe has been reset. Everything's so possible that even Wonder Woman and Superman could be together. But Byrne and Perez very quickly end that possibility in Action 600. But then we get to New 52. Universe has been reset. Everything's possible. And we get an entire Superman Wonder Woman comic where they're dating. Now, I'm not a fan of that. I'm not a fan of that book. I'm not a fan of that concept. And I'm glad they, you know, in the many retcons since 2011, they've sort of undone that piece. But it is funny that they went back to that well.
Yeah, I don't get it. There's a lot about the New 52 didn't get.
I mean, it's so long ago. I mean, 15 years almost now, 14 years. And I've actually found myself going back to try to unearth like what gems were here. Cause I tried it and then I trashed it like most people. Cause I was like,
I'm not going to read. Yeah. The Superman I'm only going to pick it up at Dan Jurgens after that other Superman's dead.
Yeah. Yeah. That book.
Oh, I'm fine. We're saying, thank you. I don't have to read that.
Yes, exactly.
It's Heroes Reborn.
There are some like the iVampire book with the, Andrea Sorrentino art is. Oh, yeah. Phenomenal. There are some gems in there, but you have
there
to kind
are.
Of dig.
I can't, I'm trying to think. Well, there's some I liked. I've liked the Flash stuff a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. There are some good books in there, and then once Rebirth happens, it all kind of catches back. But so Ross, that brings us to the end of the issue, but not quite the end of the episode, because every episode of Peace Bound and Down ends with a segment I like to call "Bringing Peace to Man's World," where the guest and I take up, you know, 30 to 60 seconds to talk about a way that we would bring peace to man's world, which is Diana's mission. This can be silly, it can be fun, it can be serious. Since you're the guest, I want you to have the last word, so I'm going to go first. Mine is actually weirdly silly and short, but I don't know why it resonated with me. So I was watching the news the other day, and I or and in it, I was watching the news online and I was scrolling through something and it clicked to an older story and I just clicked on it. And it turns out that in 1991, the voice actor who played Mickey Mouse and the voice actor who played Minnie Mouse married in real life. And I don't know why, but just knowing that made me feel happy for reasons I can't explain. I don't know what it – I mean, look, I'm not going to get into the Disney of it all and the corporateness of it all. But for some reason, Mickey and Minnie falling in love in real life just warmed my cold little heart. And I wanted everybody else to know about it because I think it'll make some people who are listening happy. So a really small, really minor bringing peace to man's world for me, but it made me happy this week. So what about you?
Mine is going to be very comic centric. The new Superman movie, I absolutely love. And for one reason, I say that's the Superman movie we need now.
Yeah.
Because that Superman, which is very much like the post-crisis Superman, I think a lot of it, but that he is that being kind is punk rock and do it's, you know, I got to save the dog. Why? Because he's alone and scared. You know, that kind of Ed Pa talking. It's definitely the way the world's going. I would rather more people of that sentiment. I want to hope a lot of people see the Superman movie and get the point.
Yeah, I 100% agree.
You know, that would make me very happy. So.
It was a phenomenal movie, but more important than the movie was the message. And and it's, you know what I loved? It was unafraid of it. It didn't hide it. It didn't like let it peek out for a minute, but then was kind of embarrassed about it. I love that they're like, no, we're wearing it on our shirt. We are fully embracing the four-colored nature of this and that, you know, the S means hope. And we're not going to shy away from it. I loved it. I agree with you 100%. I love that movie as a sign of maybe a return to sanity for the world focus on kindness and love. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I saw the moment with Pa. And my father never said that to me, but I kind of like had to pop my, you know, oh, yeah, that's what my dad taught me. All these, my certain traits of me, of him, the good ones. So I'm like, okay, these good ones are him. These bad ones is Ma. But
that's awesome.
But that kind of thing. I love Pa, Ma and Pa. That's my also thing. They look like farmers. They don't look like models.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They're not starring from, they're not formerly from Dukes and Hazzard.
Always bug me. Always. It's kind of creepy. They're
fully agree. I loved that version of Ma and Pa Kent in the movie. So, Ross, thank you so much for joining me. I love when we get to record together. And I'm a big fan of your shows, in especially Opal City Confidential, because I'm a huge Starman fan. But why don't you tell the listeners where they can find you and your work?
Okay. They can. Yes, I have a podcast called Stop, Let's Team Up. And it's made up. It's kind of like made up of different shows. If we do, I will do things, anything that involves a super team or super or team up. But there are some regular shows, Fantastic Four, 4x4, me and Kirby are reading Fantastic Four, 4 issues at a time. Then Kirby's wonderful Zoo Crew Review, his coverage of Captain Carrot and his amazing Zoo Crew.
Awesome.
It is definitely, if you've never read that comic, it is a lot of fun. And Kirby's episodes are great. And the Opal City Confidential, a Starman podcast, where I'm just covering I'll be covering all Starman while I'm reading the Jack Knight Starman run. And he has just gone to space, and I'm very excited about that.
Oh, God, that's such a good – I mean, every era of that book is great. And what's so funny is I also loved Will Payton Starman. I mean, that book tails off a little bit at the end, but the Stern Lyle years?
Very good.
Yeah, phenomenal.
I liked it a lot. I got into the second half, and I haven't – I paused. It's like – because I've liked a few issues and not liked, you know, been a little bit like, all right. But I do like the ending.
Oh, me too.
I do like his ending. I like that. That was a good event because you only needed a handful of comics to read it.
Yeah.
And there was real, you did know who's someone, you knew someone was going to die.
Yeah. And it makes sense.
From the get-go. They didn't, it's not like we even knew. It's just from the tone of the book, you're like, this is a good end well for people.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Is I actually root harder for a return of Will Payton than I do Jack Knight, because I'm so worried about if Jack Knight comes back and it's not only Robinson, but not that era of Robinson.
No, I would take Will coming back. And oh my God, I think I heard somewhere he may be back.
He did come back for a bit during Scott Snyder's Justice League run.
Okay, that's what it is. And he's the combination of the two. Well, where the hell is he from?
So he came back as Will Payton. He came back as Will Payton Starman in the Scott Snyder JLA run that led up to like Dark Knight's death metal. But yeah, that whole era is so confusing for me.
What's confusing to me is like that. I was like, have you retconned? One, they retconned the Justice Society, and it was weird.
Yeah,
I tried to read it, and I was like, this is triggering.
Yeah,
what are you doing here?
I can't. I read it in real time, and was so frustrated because it just was incomprehensible. And I'm a lifelong fan, and then people over the years have now actually said, no, go back. It's actually surprisingly really good. So at some point I'll do a reading project and I'll go back and read that whole era.
Maybe it reads better in a chunk.
That's what I think.
There's a lot of modern comics that I go, I'm going to wait for the trade because this is, I want my word balloons.
Yeah. No, and I agree with you. I think this is one of those eras that I'll read better in retrospect, and so I'll go back. But thank you so much again for joining me, and listeners, again, I super encourage you to check out Ross's shows. They're amazing, ton of fun, and if you're a fan of Jack Knight, which you should be, you should absolutely tune in for his shows. Listeners, we'll be back in just a moment after a podcast promo break with feedback from Wonder Woman Volume 2, Issue 14, which I covered with my special guest, Al Sedano.
Imagine a podcast that celebrates the things we love. Why spend time being so angry and cynical about our fandoms? Join me, the Irredeemable Shag, for a show where we're just trying to be happy. The Once Upon a Geek Podcast. Our discussions focus on a variety of geeky subjects that we're passionate about. While the topics will be ever-changing, our focus will be on science fiction, comic books, what it means to be a geek in this world, and other nostalgia-fueled ideas. Life is short. Focus on the positive. Find your joy. The Once Upon a Geek Podcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
We are back from that podcast promo break to cover your feedback for Wonder Woman Issue 14, which I covered with my buddy Al Sedano. As always, I encourage you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts and to leave feedback at fireandwaterpodcast.com as it helps folks to find the show. Clint Robinson, host of Coffee and Comics and Fan Films Friday, is up first commenting on my story about my wife's obsessive love of coffee. Clinton simply states, Sean, after listening to this episode, I love your wife. You're still pretty high on my list, thanks Clinton, for the Ross family, but she's clearly tops. And yes, I can attest Al's coffee setup is a thing of envy. It is by far the gold standard. Well, Clinton, thanks for writing in and listening. I'm glad you and Al and my wife all bond on coffee, which to this day I will argue tastes like liquid, but coffee's so gross, dude. It's gross. It's bitter. It smells good. I mean, it's got that going for it, which is nice, but no. I say no. Sorry, Clinton. Network All-Star Paul Kien, host of DC Special Cast, writes in next saying, great episode. Agree on the coffee. Thank you, Paul. I've never liked it. I'm an iced tea guy. Me too. In fact, my wife can't stand coffee either. Well, it's nice to know that there are some households on the network that have similarly good taste. Paul goes on to say, when you were asking Al about Hercules stepping down onto Paradise Island, I had the exact same thought. I did read pre-Crisis Wonder Woman and was very much in the, oh no, don't step on the island camp. I vividly remember reading this at the time it came out and being surprised. Great call out. Yeah, thanks, Paul. Al and I both, and George draws your attention to that moment because he shows Hercules' foot, you know, closer and closer and closer. And all of us are such pre-crisis babies that we're like, no, the Amazons will lose their power and immortality. And, you know, we're all panicking. So it's a funny moment that we all picked up on. Paul goes on to say, the plot point of Hippolyta coming around to Diana being the ambassador was a stroke of brilliance by Perez, in my opinion. Totally agree. Great job, of course, on another great issue. Thanks, Paul. Tim Price, host of The Outcasters, writes in to say, I'm glad that Heracles indeed has his reckoning with Hippolyta and the Amazons in this issue. One thing that I did notice in the opening is that he doesn't use the kindest language with Diana as she flies in both times. He says to her, this is no place for the likes of you, which has pretty obvious connotations. But given that he's literally holding up an entire island, I'll understand that he's not in a good headspace. And by contrast, his behavior later was much better. That's very true, Tim. Tim goes on to say, as for him stepping on Themyscira's ground, it reminded me of a pre-crisis story which was not in Wonder Woman series, but a previous story
story printed in DC Comics Presents number 41, which debuted her new uniform, changing from the eagle emblem to the double W. The fact this happened outside her own comic is a fascinating topic on its own, but my point was that the story had Diana go home to ask her mother about the changing of her costume, just to find all of the Amazons in chains by Hermes and Hercules. The comment was made in that story, Hercules' demigodhood is enough to keep the Amazons from losing their powers, but not to prevent rendering them powerless after binding in chains. Excuse me. The parallel to this issue's scene is extraordinary, not to mention the roles of Hermes and Hercules slash Heracles in both stories. It doesn't feel intentional, but I appreciate it nonetheless. Yeah, a great callback, Tim, to a really interesting issue, and I like that no prizing. I think if they did eventually want to go back to the whole No Men on Paradise Island thing, which they don't, that they could very much argue Hercules is a demigod, and Zeus even brings him up to Olympus at the end of this issue. So, you know, the rules don't apply. Tim goes on to say, even more than Hippolyta giving Diana a new mission in Man's World, the final page with Diana and Julia gives me all the feels. Now that I'm much older than when I first read the issue, and a father twice over with kids in college, their reunion choked me up on this reread. When Julia says to Diana, as if I'd let you live anywhere else, I said, absolutely. This was such a great episode, guys. Thank you. Well, thanks, Tim. Thanks for pointing that out, too. I mean, you know, Brett Young, I'm surprised, didn't follow up saying, well, of course she wouldn't let her live anywhere else. She's charging her exorbitant rent. But no, I also felt that way. I took a beat when you said both of your kids were in college because, you know, just having known you for a really long time, you know, and being friends and friends online and podcast buddies, you know, I've watched your kids, you know, kind of grow up. And my kid is now 16. So, you know, that's shocking to me. And so it's so funny, you know, it's all of our kids keep aging. What are they doing? And yet we keep staying the same age, right? To paraphrase with a much more innocent context, to paraphrase Matthew McConaughey, none of us are in our 50s. No, that's not possible. The delightful Martin Gray, who reviews Comics Weekly at the Too Dangerous for a Girl blog, comments, your description of Wonder Woman and Hercules looking sexy when they're landing on Paradise Island sent me straight back to issue 14 for a reminder. And yes, Perez obviously enjoys drawing a chunky monkey. I love that you dove back into the issue just for that panel. It is a sexy panel. Al and I both zoomed in on it immediately, but I also love that you call Hercules a chunky monkey. Look, the thing you have to give Perez is he's not afraid of the male gaze, and he is not afraid of the female gaze. That man gives equal real estate to men and women both, and it's delightful. He's, you know, the most beautiful people exist in any Perez issue. Martin goes on to say, commenting on a secret question, my favorite example of a couple getting back together is the two characters in Kiss Me Kate, Fred and Lily, because you get a great song and dance and a character named Lois Lane. I love Kiss Me Kate. I haven't read it since college, Martin. I do not remember a Lois Lane in there. I definitely have to go back and look at it, but I love Kiss Me Kate. I love the modern retellings of it. There's a moonlighting episode, again, showing my age, where they effectively just redo Kiss Me Kate, and it's adorable. Yeah, anyway, great callback and to a great play. Super Captain is up next saying, this was a great episode focusing on a truly great issue to cap off the first year or so of Perez's stories. Sean, my wife also had a problem with the glimmer of a Heracles and Hippolyta romance in this issue. And just like Al did on the podcast, I responded by saying, well, that was how many thousands of years ago? But yes, while I appreciate the redemption of Hercules angle and the forgiveness shown by the Amazons, you can do without that without coupling Hercules and Hippolyta with her former abuser, a la Luke and Laura on General Hospital. Super Captain, your comment made me so happy. I am a lifer for General Hospital. So I have two older sisters who effectively raised me. My mom was a single mom, worked multiple jobs. So my sisters are like my second and third mom. And they were addicted to General Hospital in the 80s. And then at some point when we got a VCR, they would tape General Hospital every day and then come home from school or work and watch it. And then I got in the same habit because I'd been watching that show literally since the Luke and Laura days. And it's so funny because people, you know, I mean, Luke and Laura are legendary. What is it like 7 million people watched their wedding? I mean, you know, look, admittedly, it was the 80s and you could be a sex symbol and have Anthony Geary's hair. Rest in peace, Anthony Geary actually just passed away. But, you know, it was crazy. And then to General Hospital's credit, many years later, when their children, Lulu in particular, is older, they come back to that very real captured on tape in the story moment that Luke and Laura's first time together was an assault. And so anyway, and they don't explain it away. Luke, you know, Luke doesn't try to justify it. He, you know, apologizes. He, everything you can do, but still they confront it. And it is, another example of that. And it is, it's super uncomfortable, right? I mean, Hercules and Hippolyta, I agree with you. There could have been an amends. There could have been a redemption. They didn't have to do that extra step, which is just so problematic. So love the book, love Perez, love Ween. This is an uncommon misstep for them, in my opinion.
Super Captain continues commenting on the secret question about a movie that you watched again and again on cable when you were a kid. He says, as soon as I heard the question, I said out loud, Eddie and the Cruisers, which is hilarious because Sean, it was my answer as well, actually. He says, I love this movie. I had the John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band soundtrack and still knew every song by heart. Eddie was Springsteen with a dose of Jim Morrison and a splash of Elvis. When we had HBO for a short time, around 1984 to 85, I watched it at least a dozen times. I've even referred to a certain New Jersey university, Fairleigh Dickinson, as Fairly Ridiculous for years because of a line in the movie. Happy holiday, Sean. And as always, thanks for the podcast. Well, thanks for listening, Super Captain. As always, I love that you also love Eddie and the Cruisers. It was a great movie. I almost am afraid to go back and watch it now because I have such a fondness for it from when I was a kid. Up next is Network All-Star and host of the Fantastic Poor, Brett Young, who writes in saying, great show as always. My favorite panel was Dionysus' perfect upside-down wine pour on page 10. Not a surprise that Brett caught that. Brett goes on to say, I'm not crazy about the Amazons letting Hercules off the hook. I guess, as you guys said, it can be explained somewhat since they're immortals and time's passing can heal even the most horrific wounds. I do take umbrage with the Steve Trevor part of the story. Not that he and Etta dust the attic the hard way while his aunt is setting the table. Good for them. It's that his aunt's place is described as a, quote, modest rural home, close quote, in Oklahoma. Modest? That place has at least 5 bedrooms based on the size of it. Man, I wish real estate worked in real life the way it does in the DC universe. Of course, when it comes to real estate, nothing can beat Julia's fleet of homes. Each one has its own library. Sean might be right about each house has a husband buried beneath it. I love the show and looking forward to a new year of it. Thank you, Brett, and thank you for once again taking a chance to dump on Julia Capitellis. As he always does, and this has become one of my favorite traditions in the feedback, Bucky749 brings us home with a secret question of his own, asking, if you had to pick the 3 best movies to explain the true meaning of Christmas to the Amazons, which would you pick? That's a great question, Bucky. I would open with Love Actually. I know that movie has not aged perfectly. There's some parts in it that are maybe problematic, but I don't care. I love it. It's charming. The cast is charming. And I think the Amazons would really love the young boy that Liam Neeson's stepfather to, racing through the airport, risking detainment at Guantanamo Bay to kiss the girl he loves goodbye. My next choice would be Elf, which Diana would totally relate to because it's a stranger in a strange land story. And, you know, that would just sing to her at this time in her journey. And finally, I would show them Die Hard because the Amazons would respect John McClane's badassery. Well, thank you once again, everybody, for listening. Thank you, everybody, for writing in. Feedback's my favorite part of the episodes, my favorite part of the show. It just wouldn't be the same without all of you. And I just so appreciate you taking the time to listen to this silly little show of mine. So thanks, everybody. Take care. And thanks for joining me to bring a little bit of peace to man's world.